and exciting pops up. But those in the midst of the maelstrom of millions of meetings and exchanges know that it's a game of odds. The more interactions you have, the better your chances of hitting on the one combination of people and ideas that creates the explosive pow of innovation. The frequent encounters also create what Nee calls knowledge spillover. One person has an idea or insight that he can't use directly in his own work, so he shares it with someone else over a beer or at a meetup event. That person finds it to be just the link she needs in the company she's trying to start. We expect people to be competitive and guard their ideas, but instead there's a great willingness to share without any expectation of getting help back, said Nee. Making an investment in your reputation by sharing knowledge is very rational, because others in the group see it and know you're a reliable person, so there may be indirect reciprocity. In other words, helping someone else gets everyone on your side and makes them want to contribute to your lucky outcomes. If you're outside the rarefied air of Stanford or the New York high-tech community, as most of us are, you can still use the principle of finding luck in other people. You may go to a mom's group, a book club, a yoga studio, or a Lions Club meeting to make some of those serendipitous connections. You can always read a book curled on the couch or do a side plank pose in your own bedroom, but you open yourself to lucky opportunities when you share the experience and have other people around you. Many of us like some time to sit alone and work or think or relax, and that can definitely be part of good days. But lucky sparks happen when people rub against each other. I've always liked to think that being competent and talented is enough, but Barnaby convinced me that connections and personal networks often make the difference. What appears to the outside world as random luck often comes from networking behind the scenes. He pointed out that the movie My Big Fat Greek Wedding is regularly used as an example of a hit that came from nowhere. It's true that it was made on a shoestring, which now means $2 million, but writer and star Nia Vardalos also found a way to get the movie to Rita Wilson, who she knew was proudly Greek. Wilson agreed to help and brought it to her husband, Tom Hanks, who had his production company invest in the movie and work on its distribution. Luck, maybe, but the kind of luck that comes from connecting to other people. So how do you actually start making connections? The easiest way to expand your luck network may be through social media. It doesn't take much effort to add a new friend on Facebook or up your number of Twitter posts. But this is only step one, and many studies suggest that online connections don't really replace face-to-face encounters. When social media guru Sri Srinivasan used Facebook in his job search, it was just a way to invite people to meet with him in person via his daily walks. The vast majority of people looking for jobs use online sources, and there's no reason not to. But studies suggest that anywhere from 40 to 80% of people land jobs through direct contact with friends, colleagues, and connections. Having coffee with a former colleague may lead to more luck in the work world than another hour on LinkedIn. The same pattern is true if you're looking to get lucky in love. 40 million or so Americans now use online dating sites, so these are a good way of expanding your potentially lucky links. But according to a 2016 Pew survey, even among people who have been with their partner for 5 years or less, fully 88% met through real-world connections. That may be changing. A recent survey from Match.com found that 39% of people now meet online. You can take these various survey numbers with a grain of salt, if not a whole shakerful, but you also have to remember that meeting is just the first step, and nobody gets married online. After you've swiped right on Tinder, you still have to do the face-to-face part. Connect for a drink, get to know each other, decide if this is the person who will make you lucky in the future. You can't miss the overall conclusion that luck comes from connecting directly with other people. Shortly after I graduated from college and moved to New York, I met a man named Henry Jarecki, who became a lifelong friend. He's a couple of decades older than me and has made at least 3 fortunes on companies that he built and sold. Even if I don't see him for months at a time, I always think of him as one of my closest friends. And there are probably dozens of other people who keep him on the top of their speed dial, too. However busy he is at work, Henry always has time for the personal. Connecting people, helping friends, making other people lucky. People like Henry, who are always trying to make others lucky, make themselves lucky too. Henry is an obsessive list maker, and he can produce an index of all the lucky encounters he had over the years that helped create some of his success. He also keeps a list he's written of all the friends, colleagues, and associates who made a difference for him. He is powerfully aware that nobody succeeds on their own. "I marvel at how lucky I was to be surrounded by such smart, talented people," he told me one day as we sat in his expansive townhouse on Gramercy Park. "But you made that luck," I said. "You knew what you wanted, and you made life interesting enough that everyone likes to be around you." Henry nodded, but he looked dubious, so I asked him what he thought his number one secret was for making luck happen. He didn't hesitate on that. "I went to every party," he said with a grin. Henry meant it both literally and metaphorically. He gets a lot of invitations to parties and events and celebrations, and throws many too. And though he insists that he's mostly a cerebral kind of guy who would prefer being alone in his office with his papers than standing in a loud room with a drink in his hand, he always made himself go. The party he skipped might be the one at which he would have met the person who could change his life. He also realized that opportunities appear when you least expect them, and they were more likely to pop out at that party than in his office. When he went to parties, Henry made a big impression on everyone he met. He doesn't hide the fact that he is a complete original. When he was young, he wore thick glasses and told great stories and wowed people as a charismatic intellectual. Now that he's older, he likes to entertain on one of the islands he owns in the British Virgin Islands, wearing a long caftan. He has a brilliant mind and a genius IQ, and as was true of Steve Jobs in his black turtlenecks or Mark Zuckerberg in his hoodies, Jarecki's style announces that he's going to head in his own directions in both his business life and his personal one. If you like that message, you can come along. If you have a more traditional or conservative approach, you might want to talk to someone else at the party. People like Henry, with strong personalities and their own style, stand out at parties and are more likely to be remembered. Others think of them when an opportunity arises. But you can make luck with other styles, too. When I discussed Henry's go-to-every-party approach later with Barnaby, he turned to one of his nature analogies again and said that it reminded him of fishing. Cast 5 lines into the water, and you're more likely to reel something in than if you use just 2 lines. And since you can't have too much of a good metaphor, Barnaby pointed out that commercial fishermen rely on a variety of techniques, depending on what they're trying to catch. The big factory ships toss out huge nets to catch everything in the area. They have to decide how big the holes in the netting will be, since with very small holes, you don't miss any fish, but you also pull in a lot of sea junk and garbage. When they're after specific kinds of higher quality fish, they'll take the time to bait each hook separately and with care. And for the biggest and most valuable fish, like the bluefin tuna, where a single fish can sell for hundreds of thousands of dollars, fishing companies use helicopters to scout from the air and find the fish to target. The bigger point here is pretty clear. You have to know what you want before you start fishing for luck, and one technique doesn't work for everyone or every goal. Throw a big net and there's a good chance you'll haul in something you want, but you have to be willing to put up with a lot of junk, too. Cast just a couple of lines and the odds are lower but more focused. I thought of my friend Marnie, who was gregarious and outgoing and so full of energy that she could talk to a rock and make it her friend. Lucky things seem to happen to her all the time, but, as we're now discovering, it's not random. Since she talks to everyone, she's like the fisherman who casts 5 lines and always pulls something in. When she was going to Austin, Texas recently to visit her older son, I asked where she would be staying, and she laughed and rolled her eyes. "One of those crazy lucky things that happened to me," she began. On her last trip to Austin, she had gone to a funky local coffee shop and, of course, started chatting to the woman next to her in line. By the time their artisanally brewed coffees arrived, they were laughing and having so much fun that they sat down together to keep talking. When they finally left, the woman explained that she traveled a lot, so Marnie was welcome to stay in her condo in Austin anytime she visited her son. "So that's where I'm staying," Marnie said delightedly. "Can you imagine how lucky that is?" Yes, lucky. But I could also imagine how many other people could go to that same coffee shop and not end up with a new friend who offered to be their local innkeeper. Marnie's good luck occurred for the same reason that Shree's did. Both of them discovered the advantages of having many lines out to catch unexpected luck. It's also noteworthy that it wasn't a friend who offered the condo, but a weaker tie. The big net approach doesn't work for everyone or every goal, and that's okay too. Being thoughtful and focused in your interactions, a couple of carefully baited lines, can sometimes lead to even more luck than a brasher and more scattershot approach. If that tends to be your style, you can still be lucky. Back in 2003, writer Jonathan Rauch wrote an article for The Atlantic called "Caring for Your Introvert" that was one of the magazine's most popular pieces online for many years. He clearly hit a chord among people tired of being told that they needed to talk and socialize more to be successful. Rauch pointed out that introverts aren't necessarily shy, they're just calmer, more reflective, and usually more independent-minded. Extroverts are energized by other people, while introverts tend to wilt after being social for too long and need to be alone to recharge. Author Susan Cain expanded on that idea in her 2012 bestseller, Quiet, pointing out that our current culture of personality has made it seem that everybody needs to be an extrovert to function well. But introverts form loyal alliances through one-on-one interactions, and they're the ones getting luckier and luckier these days. In a follow-up interview a few years after his famous article, Rauch noted that geeks, the classic introverts, have been romanticized by Silicon Valley, so the digital economy is giving introverts a new place in the sun. But none of this is an excuse to hide away and turn on the TV. Introverts can be as sociable as anyone else. If you want to make luck, you have to connect to people, in one style or another. And that means making yourself go to the party or start the conversation. Sometimes you have to make yourself do something that's not completely natural to make luck. Your own temperament may determine whether you talk to everyone at the party or sit quietly with just a couple of others. But with the right focus and attitude, you can make the connections that will help you capture luck. Since I enjoyed testing out the theories Barnaby and I were creating, I decided to see if I could get lucky by making an effort to connect with someone I didn't previously know. I happened to be traveling a lot, giving speeches, and typically on flights I'd put on my Bose headphones and talk only to the flight attendant to order my Diet Coke. But returning from Montreal one afternoon, I left off the headphones, and as we taxied down the runway, I glanced over at the man sitting next to me. He had a stack of magazines like Variety and Hollywood Reporter, which suggested we might be in similar fields. That was interesting. Maybe I should cast a well-curated line and try to make luck. I smiled at my seatmate, but had no idea how to open the conversation. So I said something clever, like, "You have a lot of magazines there." He nodded and then gestured to the cover of one of the magazines. He had a much better way to start. "Do you think it's real?" he asked. "Is what real?" I asked, confused. "That." He moved the magazine closer to me and pointed. "Kim Kardashian's butt. I don't think it's real, do you?" Kim Kardashian's butt did not seem like a road to luck. But heck, you have to see where things lead. "I'm not sure I really care about the Kardashians," I admitted. "I'm in the entertainment business. I have to care about everything," he said with a friendly smile. I mentioned that I'd been a TV producer, so we started talking and playing the who-do-you-know game, and before long I felt like Marnie, making a new friend. His name was David Steinberg, and it turned out he was, among other things, the personal manager for huge stars, including Bette Midler and Billy Crystal, and the much-missed Robin Williams. When I told him that I was now investigating luck, he gave a big smile. "Making luck happen is what I've done my whole career," he said. Working with Billy and Bette and Robin, he'd seen how even the biggest talents needed to see possibilities and grab opportunities, or sometimes craft their own. He had so many stories that the 90-minute flight wasn't nearly enough. When we landed, we agreed to have lunch together sometime in New York. I got off the plane feeling the same exhilaration I had on my lucky Friday the 13th. Making luck happen wasn't just a theory, I could actually do it. Maybe not every time and certainly not every day, but just being aware of the principles, like luck is other people, changed your focus and let you pay attention to the right things. In this case, I'd cast a line and met someone interesting. He wasn't lending me a condo in Austin, but not every connection needs an immediate payoff. Over lunch at the Red Eye Grill a couple of weeks later, I realized that David had something even better for me than a condo. Great stories about people making luck for other people. He said that when he started out in his own career, he didn't realize how he was making his own luck. But reflection and many years made it all clearer. "Can I include your stories in my book?" I asked. "Sure, if anyone wants to hear about a guy from Milwaukee," he said with a laugh. David grew up in Wisconsin, put himself through college selling aluminum siding, and quickly realized that this wasn't the job he wanted for his whole life. He moved to Los Angeles and got a job in the mailroom of an ad agency. "But I didn't like that either," he said. "I wanted to be one of the guys sitting in an office getting my mail delivered to me." So he started calling people to get a lead, and it turned out that he had a cousin who was married to a guy who knew another guy in Hollywood who... I smiled to myself. I didn't really need to get the connections right. It was just more proof of how weak ties make luck. The various connections led to a publicist doing a favor and giving David a job at his agency, which was where David met Sammy Davis Jr. They immediately bonded. David was half Sammy's age, but they both liked to go to every party. At the time, Sammy was part of a celebrated circle of celebrities, and there was no bigger star. "He wanted to have as much fun as I did," David said. "I had a credit card with a $250 limit, but I was traveling around the world with him and going to dinner parties with Frank Sinatra and Lucille Ball. I met everybody." Those connections led to possibilities, and eventually he started his own PR company out of the back of Sammy's office. "I just kept running. Whenever there was an opportunity, I put myself in that place," he told me. David instinctively realized that if you want other people to make you lucky, you need to make them feel lucky too. Life doesn't track one way. Early in his career, when he was, as he joked, apparently successful but realistically broke, David was going to dinner at the Hotel Bel Air one night with six Hollywood friends. He saw it as his chance to be generous, so he gave his credit card to the maitre d' ahead of time, not realizing that one of the guests, the actor Peter Sellers, had pre-ordered for the whole table. All of a sudden, there were mounds of caviar coming out and rack of lamb, and I thought, "I am now one credit card statement away from disaster," he said. But he let the card go through, amazed that it wasn't denied. He knew it was important to give as well as take. Later, when he became a manager, he produced various shows for Robin Williams and Billy Crystal, took notes on their live performances, and helped them develop some of their material. "My job was just to make them look good," he said. A manager's motivations can be tinged by self-interest. "We're human, not robots," he said. But since he was known for integrity and putting his clients first, his career kept getting bigger. By making others lucky, he increased his own luck, too. "I flunked out of college twice, and I was a discipline problem growing up, but I had good instincts and understood comedy," he said. "I never took myself too seriously or told anyone why I'm so important, but I was interested in other people and liked to get new experiences, and that all made me lucky." Other people can make you lucky when you give to them without worrying about what will come back. You pay for dinner at the Bel Air. You help a big star become even bigger. You offer to work for free just to be around interesting people. He did that early in his career, too. "David had met me on a plane, but he spent 3 hours at lunch sharing great stories and insights without expecting a return. And when the check came and I reached for it, he grabbed it and rolled his eyes. 'Really?' he asked." Making someone else feel lucky without knowing how or if you'll get it back can be a risk, but it's a risk worth taking. Not every person you meet is going to help you make luck, but you need only a couple, and you can still have fun and interesting times with the rest. David was the Hollywood example of what Professor Nee had described as investing in your reputation by sharing knowledge. As so often happens to people who do that, what came back for him was buckets of luck. Dr. Barabasi, who had shared his cocktail party theory, pointed out in one of his books that once upon a time people were born into communities and had to find their individuality. Today, people are born individuals and have to find their communities. Being part of a community opens you to a network of possibilities. Being part of many communities expands your weak ties and invisible webs and dramatically increases the chance of lucky events coming your way. I left the lunch thinking of all the different ways that luck comes from other people. And I also realized that to make that luck happen, you need to take action within your social circles, however you define them, and do so in a way that feels genuine to you. You might pick up the phone and call an acquaintance you haven't spoken to in a year. At a coffee shop or a local park or on an airplane, look up and take in the people around you. Maybe there is someone sipping their latte or walking their dog who can help you plant the seeds for luck. If you think about what you need to get lucky and let as many people as possible know about it, you can essentially form your own luck circle and watch it pay off. The luck we bring each other can be mutual and expansive. You have to know how to take the opportunities and share them and give them back. Because whoever you are, from New York's chief digital officer to Bette Midler's manager, you need other people to help you get lucky. Chapter 6. Zig When Others Zag. Take your own path. Be willing to think different. Cultivate unpredictability. The more I got to know Barnaby, the more I realized that he was unconventional. Growing up in Alaska as the oldest of five children, he was mostly self-taught and spent a lot of time in the outdoors. You can learn a lot watching salmon swim upstream. The first time he stepped into a real classroom was when he arrived at college. He wondered for a while what he had missed, and even volunteered at two local area high schools his freshman year at Harvard to find out. I realized that I was lucky to have been able to follow my own interests and learn how to solve problems for myself, he told me one morning. When everyone else was on the main road with a standard curriculum, I was on a side street and getting my own view. Barnaby was convinced that swerving off the main road was sometimes the best way to make yourself lucky. Most people stick with what he called the main institutional flow, but that can keep you from seeing different and original approaches. Lucky people are often the outliers who find a path that others missed, he said. Social and institutional structures set the norms, but if you are willing to take some risks and step around those, you sometimes find better ways to create and capture value. The people who look for possibilities outside the accepted flow often create the greatest luck for themselves and others. The previous day, Barnaby had visited his friend Dr. James Watson at the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory. Though close to 90, Dr. Watson remains vigorous and outspoken. He wanted to be a professional ornithologist when he was young, a passion he shares with Barnaby, but he took up the emerging field of genetics when he was a student in graduate school. He had strong opinions and a curious mind, and was definitely not a go-with-the-flow guy. The willingness to think in completely new directions helped Dr. Watson back in 1953 when he discovered, along with Francis Crick, the structure of DNA. It was one of the greatest scientific breakthroughs of the century and led to his winning a Nobel Prize. A lot of luck in life is seeing what others don't see, he told Barnaby. You rarely make great breakthroughs by staying only on a standard path. In any field, there are social pressures to follow others and work on what is currently popular. But over lunch, Dr. Watson had exhorted Barnaby not to worry about being conventional. One must think for oneself, he said. Being novel does not always come naturally, but to be special and know what you can do, you must try new things. Dr. Watson could discuss science and the double helix all day and night, but as his wonderfully titled memoir, Avoid Boring People, suggests, he doesn't want to bore anyone. The title has a second meaning that's just as important. The renowned biologist doesn't like to be around anyone or anything, boring or expected. Too many people go in obvious directions and they don't recognize new possibilities, he told Barnaby. People are afraid. They don't take the new paths because they worry what others think of them. They are weak. For Dr. Watson, the excitement of life came from always pushing forward in new directions, even if it was sometimes in opposition to what most around him believed. If you're willing to be like Dr. Watson and avoid the mundane and obvious, you can make luck outside the laboratory, too. Back when I was a television producer, I worked with a network executive named Mike Darnell, who was one of the most daring people I'd ever met. Smart, innovative, and creative, he had more cutting-edge ideas in a day than most people have in a year. And he didn't care how off the wall or unusual they were, or how much his bosses bristled when he proposed them. In a business where everybody imitates each other, Darnell made a career of being a complete original. I couldn't wait to talk to him again, and I was thrilled to discover that after many years at Fox, he was now running the television division at Warner Brothers. "You're the main person I miss from my TV days," I told him. "I miss you too. We had so much fun," he said, with the joyous excitement that was always his hallmark. I loved hearing about Darnell's new position because he didn't look like a guy who would be top dog at a network. Just over 5 feet tall, he had kept the long curly hair and elfin smile that brought him success as a child actor. He liked to wear jeans and cowboy boots, though he'd stopped wearing the matching hat. Back when we worked together, you could tell it was a really important day if he was wearing a button-down shirt instead of a flannel one. I probably shouldn't have favorites among TV executives, but he was always my favorite. In the late 1990s, well before reality television became its own genre, Darnell did specials at the Fox network like When Animals Attack and Breaking the Magician's Code that caused controversy but also got big ratings. "All those crazy specials. Nobody else thought of doing those shows when I started. I was looking for a lane I could take where I didn't have to compete with everyone," Darnell told me now. "Really, that's how I started, looking for a different lane that would be my own." Darnell swerved into the reality television lane and, at the time, found himself virtually the only one there. He was slightly offended that the rest of the TV community looked down on his shows, but he had a tough skin. He liked getting ratings and attention, and just shrugged when one competing network exec snottily announced that he'd rather fail with quality than succeed with garbage. "He definitely found a way to fail," Darnell said with a laugh, "but I wanted to succeed." He was given a title as head of alternative programming, and really, that's what he was, an alternative direction for the network. Other executives were never quite sure what to make of Darnell, who clearly followed the beat of his own drum. He was regularly late for meetings, and sometimes drove an hour or two in the middle of the day in order to go home and have lunch with his wife, Carolyn. If the others warily accepted his quirkiness, it was because he seemed to have a recipe for success that nobody else could quite copy. And the main ingredient in his formula was to go in a direction different from that of everybody else. "Sometimes it's finding a path that nobody else takes that catapults you to success," Darnell said. "I almost got fired a few times, but everyone in this industry gets fired. I'd rather go out screaming and yelling and making a big deal than just trying to get along." At about the time that Darnell was swerving into a new lane with his TV specials, Apple launched an advertising campaign that featured iconic figures from Thomas Edison to Gandhi to Amelia Earhart and urged people to think different. As one of the commercials put it, "Here's to the crazy ones, the misfits." Apple and Mike Darnell and James Watson all understood that being one of the crazy ones can bring you the smashing success that seems, from the outside, to be the epitome of luck. You can be perfectly happy following a standard route, but if you want to make luck and change your own corner of the world, it helps to go in a different direction. As we continued to talk, Darnell reminded me that when music mogul Simon Fuller came to Hollywood to pitch a show, none of the other network's executives would take a meeting with him. Darnell eagerly met with him and, excited by Fuller's idea, bought his show as a summer replacement. Darnell had seen similar shows that aired in the United Kingdom and instinctively knew that he wanted this one, called American Idol. Yep, Darnell was the guy who brought America American Idol. Unless you've taken a side trip to Mars in the last decade, you know the rest. The show became a cultural icon and one of the most successful programs in television history. Taking a bold stand for what you want can bring in huge luck returns, but it takes a certain amount of courage. Darnell, though, laughs at the word. He insists that he's not one of those rare, wild and crazy guys whom you can admire but not emulate. "In real life, I don't like roller coasters or scary rides, and I take no risks. I don't even like change. I'm married to the same wife, and I stayed at Fox forever," he said. but taking a risk at work is different. In business, I've always been bold, he said. There, I'll do anything to be different. If you want to go into the lane where nobody else is driving, you have to be prepared to be attacked. The challenge is to keep believing in yourself and pushing forward. New ideas always sound like nutty ideas at first. And let's be clear, not every original idea is worth fighting for, so trying to be different also requires a certain amount of honest reflection. If nobody is buying the wasabi and peppermint rice pudding that you've just created, there could be a reason for that. But sometimes it just takes patience. For a while, nobody wanted Darnell's flavor of the day, but then everyone did. The daring direction he took quickly became mainstream, and with American Idol number one in the ratings, often by large margins, the network execs who had once berated him soon tried to copy him. He went from being the alternative guy at Fox to being the king of television at Warner Brothers, overseeing some of the studio's biggest programs. Darnell believes that going in a different direction from most people is an especially good idea when you don't start with the traditional credentials. If you're a classically handsome, 6-foot-tall rugby player who graduated from Harvard and was president of the Hasty Pudding Club, you can get attention by being the same. Your fellow Harvard alums, who are now showrunners at the networks, will be happy to invite you in for an interview. But with his unusual size and style, Darnell knew that he wasn't the obvious guy to get lucky in the intense, image-driven world of television executives. So he decided that to make his own luck, he needed to forge a different path. He had to zig when others zagged. In setting out on a jagged path, Darnell unwittingly undertook a strategy that researchers call systematic unpredictability. Charles Darwin would have seen the value of Darnell's approach, at least theoretically, since it turns out that evolution may favor people and species that take unusual paths. British biologists P.M. Driver and D.A. Humphreys spent 3 decades studying animal behavior and figured out that doing the unexpected is one of the best survival skills around. In one of their early studies, they simply tracked rabbits as they raced across a field and noticed how they made quick and nimble changes of direction. This behavior is called jinking, and the biologists originally thought that it was done specifically to dodge a predator. But then they realized that the twists and turns are different every time and take place even when the furry little rabbit isn't being pursued. Taking an unexpected path even when there's nobody on your tail gives you a leg or paw up when there is a predator around. Basically, it works so well that it has become an innate behavior in many species. The biologists call this single erratic display, and they've observed it in rabbits and squirrels and songbirds and snipes and mullet and eels and waders and many, many others. They described one bird called the black-tailed godwit that will display a quick ascending flight, alternating with steep dives inclusive of leaf scattering and quick zigzag flight low over the ground, often with sudden changes of flying direction. Whew! Now that's definitely being different. If you're unpredictable, you're less likely to get caught and more likely to survive. And there's nothing luckier than staying alive. So natural selection seems to have favored the animals, including us, who learned how to zigzag through life. A biologist would probably note that Darnell's systematic unpredictability explained his luck and survival even early in his career. When he first started out, he landed a lowly job at a local news station and tried various stunts to get himself noticed. His antics eventually caught the eye of hotshot executive Barry Diller, who was running the newly launched Fox network. Diller said to me, "You're shameless, but you're doing a good job," Darnell said now with a big laugh. With that encouragement, Darnell spent a couple of months planning his next erratic display, or lucky move. After discussing possibilities every night with his wife, he finally took an old Panasonic tape recorder and recorded the theme from Mission Impossible. Then he voiced a message saying how much he wanted to work at the network and ended it with, "Either Mike's career or this tape will self-destruct in 5 seconds." He showed up at an event that he knew Diller would attend and convinced the parking valet to give Diller the recorder. He put a big red arrow next to the play button so that Diller would know what to do. I was scared to death about what would happen, Darnell told me. My entire career was on the line. I left the tape on a Thursday. Friday, I didn't hear anything. I panicked all weekend that I'd blown my career. Then Monday morning, Barry Diller called and said, "What do you want to do with the network?" And I had no idea. I had spent months planning this, but I didn't have an answer to the simplest question. Here's the lesson. Be prepared for the moment. When luck is going to hit, you've got to be ready for it. When Darnell finally got to the network, he expected that his bosses would all be geniuses. But they weren't. And that may be one of the surprises of any job. You figure there are so many people who know a lot more than you do that you just follow along. You're afraid to take a new direction because there must be someone with more experience who knows the right way to go. Eventually, you discover that the people who think they have the answers aren't always right. You make your luck by figuring out what works best for you and going for it. The person who has the temerity to challenge the accepted wisdom and zig when everyone else zags could end up soaring. Mathematician Stephen Strogatz has such powerhouse credentials that he could have decided to follow the straight line throughout his career, going from point A to point B, as it were. He has degrees from Princeton, Cambridge, and Harvard, and is now a chaired professor at Cornell. But he's also charming and amusing, not just for a math guy, and believes that you can create luck with the unexpected. One of the sections on his website is called Fun. He has written popular math columns for the New York Times and has the best-named mathematics book ever, The Joy of X. Strogatz's zigs come with a touch of genius attached. Some of his most admired and brilliant breakthroughs happened because he was open to unconventional thoughts. If you want to get lucky or do something original and creative, you have to be willing to entertain odd ideas, he said when Barnaby and I spoke to him. Some years ago, he was working on the question of how biological rhythms get in sync, and specifically how crickets synchronize their chirps. His then PhD student, Duncan Watts, began talking with him about the 6 degrees of separation theory. You probably know the research, or at least the concept, suggesting any 2 people in the world can be connected through a small number of links. Back in 1967, the psychologist Stanley Milgram famously found that it took just 5 intermediaries to get a package from a random person in Omaha, Nebraska, to a stockbroker in Boston. Since then, other researchers have tried similar experiments online that allow bigger samples and save on postage. They've gotten roughly the same results. The idea that we're all connected seeped into popular culture in a play by John Guare called, reasonably enough, 6 Degrees of Separation, which then became a movie starring Will Smith and is frequently revived on Broadway and in theaters around the country. Watts wondered if that connectedness concept being batted around in social sciences could somehow be related to Strogatz's work and anything that has links, from the human nervous system to national power grids. It was a wacky idea at the time and a risky idea, and there were all kinds of reasons for me to avoid working on it, Strogatz said. But I was curious and liked playing around with the concept. It ended up being the biggest thing either of us will ever do in our career. The mathematical paper on small world networks, which they published in the journal Nature, is famous in the field and cited more often than any other by researchers around the world. Strogatz says that when he was working on the small networks project, most of the established scientists and mathematicians he spoke with were dismissive, but he liked the idea of going down a path that others ignored. Sometimes the best areas to pursue are the most unfashionable, he told us. There's less competition and a better chance of making your mark. At times, a path is so unfashionable that it gets written off as a complete dead end, and everyone advises that you'd be nuts to head down it. Everyone except Strogatz. He thinks revisiting dead ends can be a productive strategy in many fields, including business and academics. Think about the problem again, or have a young person think about it, because they won't be stuck in the traditional way of thinking that got you to the dead end in the first place, he said. Maybe all that's needed to open it up again is a small tweak, a slight change, or a new twist. Often everybody knows that some particular direction can't work until it works. Then everyone is equally certain on the other side. For example, no mainstream publisher would go for a book with graphic sex and S&M until Erica Mitchell, calling herself E.L. James, self-published a book called 50 Shades of Grey. People loved it, and after it was picked up by a traditional publishing house, it sold more than 125 million copies and was one of the fastest-selling books of all time. Sequels and movies and even more profits followed, and suddenly sexy books seemed like a great idea. For James, going down a dead end turned out to be an expressway to success. Mathematical theorists who study game theory, such as the late John Maynard Smith and Martin Novak, have reached the similar conclusion that the best move under highly competitive conditions is often the unpredictable one. If you want to get lucky when you're playing poker, you don't want to tip your hand so that the others at the table can predict what you'll do. Football coaches who've taken a lesson or two from game theory try to stay unpredictable enough that the opposing team doesn't always know how to line up against them. So when they're close to the goal on a fourth down, they may occasionally have the quarterback throw the ball rather than trying to rush for the end zone. The randomness matters, or the opposing team will always know exactly how to respond. In the 2015 Super Bowl, there were just seconds left to go when the Seattle Seahawks had the ball on the 1 yard line. Coach Pete Carroll called for a pass play instead of the expected rush, and the pass was intercepted. What had looked like potential victory became a miserable 28-24 defeat. Being unpredictable may work statistically, but as with anything, it's not going to work for every play. Some mathematicians tried to argue that Carroll did just what he should have, but the more fan-focused Washington Post called it the worst play call in Super Bowl history. If you move away from what's safe, you can sometimes suffer, too. When Mike Darnell concocted his Mission Impossible tape, he realized that unconventional actions can blow up into huge luck, or just blow up. Even though he was panicked, he went all in with his big risk and didn't have a backup plan. Strogatz took a more balanced approach. While pursuing what he calls paradigm-busting science in his project with Watts, he continued gathering good data from his more conventional research with the crickets. He thinks that knowing they had another option allowed them to be bold. Going down an unusual path doesn't mean being reckless. In fact, you're most likely to get lucky if you stay realistic. If you're trying something wild that's high risk but also high payoff, you don't want to bang your head on the wall for too long, Strogatz said. Take the flyer, and if it's a dud, get out quickly. When he and Watts were doing their unexpected project, they kept it top secret and met every week to assess their progress. If it wasn't going right, they were back to crickets. Sometimes the best way to get lucky is to take the most unexpected path of all and just let yourself have fun. Strogatz is convinced that lucky discoveries happen if you're willing to be playful. He is as obsessive and hardworking as anybody else in high levels of academia, but he doesn't overlook the value of having a good time. When a problem seems like fun, you'll stick with it and work on it incessantly. You'll think about it when you're in the shower or driving the car. And that increases the chance of hitting on lucky good results, he said. Playful people also try things that nobody else would dare. The sense that they're just having fun gives them the excuse to try far-out ideas, which leaves them open to new possibilities and what seems like good luck. But remember what we said about new ideas being met with ridicule? It happens over and over in every field. So if you're going to be playful or unexpected or zig when others zag, you also have to be able to shut out criticism and have some faith in yourself. When Dick Fosbury was growing up in Oregon in the 1960s, he liked sports, but he wasn't very good at any of them. He didn't make the school football and basketball teams, so he decided to try the high jump. Unfortunately, he wasn't too impressive at that either. Though he was 6'4", he could barely clear 5'4". In those days, high jumpers got over the bar with either a scissors kick, one leg and then the other, or a straddle. He tried both styles of jumping, but neither made him a winner. Then at one meet, he decided to improvise something completely different. If he couldn't win in the normal fashion, maybe he'd have luck going over the bar, well, backward. He did his takeoff and rotated in the air and soared over the bar. In a sport where success is counted in quarter-inch increments, he went an amazing 6 inches higher than his previous best. Over the next couple of years, he continued honing his style and jumping higher and higher. His technique got wide attention, and even a clever moniker associated with it, the Fosbury Flop. But however successful he was, the standard bearers of the sport considered Fosbury and his flop a sideshow amusement. The so-called experts warned that he'd never achieve anything with his backward style. Sports journalists went out of their way to find sneering metaphors to describe his technique, one describing him as looking like a guy falling off the back of a truck, and another invoking the image of a fish flopping on the bottom of a boat. But Fosbury ignored them and continued to believe in his distinctive jumping style. He surprised everyone by qualifying for the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City. As a kid from Oregon, Fosbury didn't want to miss anything about the experience of being in Mexico. The night before the opening ceremony, he drove to the Aztec pyramids at Teotihuacan with two friends and stayed there all night. In the following days, while his teammates went out to practice, Fosbury often stayed behind or tried just a few jumps. Some thought he was slacking, but he knew himself and realized that more practices wouldn't help. He needed the rush of competition to do his best. Then came the actual high jump competition, and the naysayers were caught up short. Over 2 days in Olympic Stadium, Fosbury didn't miss a single jump. He won the gold medal with a new Olympic record of 7.35 feet, or 2.24 meters, flopping his way to glory. But even the gold medal didn't convince everyone. People who follow more standard approaches don't trust those who zig when everyone else zags. Instead of seeing that there's luck to be had by going in a new direction, they feel threatened. Fosbury's backward jump meant that after he went over the bar, he hit the mat neck first. The tradition-bound Olympic team coach warned that if kids tried to imitate Fosbury, it would wipe out an entire generation of high jumpers because they will all have broken necks. The kids did copy him, and happily, all necks stayed intact. Soon the Fosbury flop was the only style any high jumper used. Every single Olympic medal in the high jump since 1972 has gone to a flopper. To be lucky in any area of life, from love to the high jump, you often have to be the outlier, willing to be the exception, and find the pathway that others have missed. If you're trying your best, and things just don't seem to be working out, maybe it's time to zig a bit. Like James Watson, Mike Darnell, Steve Strogatz, and Dick Fosbury, if you have the courage to think different, it often looks like you've gotten very lucky. But really, you've just zigged when all the others zagged. Chapter 7. The Power of Persistence and Passion. Create a lucky personality with persistence and passion. Get on a lucky path. Develop the power of optimism. On the train ride back from Princeton 1 week, Barnaby happened to be looking out the window as we passed Edison, New Jersey. The connection to the great inventor Thomas Edison, the guy who said that genius is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration, got Barnaby thinking. If you want to make luck, you have to be persistent, Barnaby said. Many of life's failures are people who did not realize how close they were to success when they gave up. That's lovely, I said, reaching for the notebook I always carried. Let me write it down. It's a quote from Thomas Edison, Barnaby said with a smile. He also said that the most certain way to succeed is always to try just one more time. Edison invented the light bulb, the phonograph, the movie camera, and 1,000 other things, or make that 1,093, the number of U.S. patents he holds. But he didn't hit on any of them by random chance. He once explained that he never failed, but he had found at least 10,000 things that didn't work. Barnaby has a soft spot for Edison because he shares the great inventor's intensity. He is convinced that if he wants something fervently enough, he will get it. He's not spoiled, he's just persistent. And his focus and intensity have made him seem very lucky. For example, when he was just 17, he decided he wanted to study with the great evolutionary biologist Ernst Mayr at Harvard, and he was going to make it happen no matter what. He flew in from Alaska and showed up at Meyer's office. His passion was so convincing that Meyer invited him to stay. And Barnaby may be the only person who ever studied at Harvard without SATs, grade transcripts, or teacher evaluations. "You get lucky when you have focus and won't quit," Barnaby told me. The comment that the harder I work, the luckier I get has been attributed to so many people that it's hard to know who actually said it. Probably all of them, from Thomas Jefferson to Samuel Goldwyn to Oprah, would agree with it. But after our conversation, Barnaby spent the next week thinking about how hard work translates to luck. Were the hardest working people really the luckiest? The connection turns out to be subtler than it seems. The persistence and focus that lead to luck come in many forms and don't necessarily equate to hours put in. Far more important may be the attitude and intensity you bring. Knowing what you want and where you're aiming is really the key, Barnaby told me when we met the following Wednesday, this time sitting at the dining room table in my apartment. I'd come to think of it as an auxiliary luck lab. Barnaby had spent the morning with his new friend Deepak Chopra, the spiritualist and New Age guru. As a scientist, Barnaby had initially been a little wary of meeting him because Chopra's ideas on alternative medicine have been attacked by many mainstream scientists. But as he got to know Chopra over many months, Barnaby was won over by Chopra's openness toward a bigger picture of reality and his insights into how we can exert control over our own lives. Through his inspirational talks, Chopra shares the idea that we can make things happen for ourselves by our own thoughts and attitudes. I had learned that telling other people in your networks and community what you want could cause lucky connections and breaks to happen, but I had a hard time believing the cultural gurus who suggested that if you simply whisper your desires to the universe, then the universe will mysteriously respond. But Barnaby said that Chopra had a deeper approach that was worth considering. He suggests that you start each day with a routine of calm focus where you ask yourself, "Who am I and what do I want?" Barnaby told me. That way you get your actions in harmony with your goals. In a much more down-to-earth way, I could see that if you're truly driven to get something, whether a job, a lover, or a good deal on a new Prius, you'll try hard and perhaps never give up. The grit and fortitude and steely resolve that come with being passionate make positive things happen. Putting your desire out to the universe just means that you know what you want. Once you've declared it to yourself, you're more likely to aim your energy and emotion in the right direction. It looks like magic, but it starts from knowing what will make you feel lucky. When I started investigating, I discovered that these ideas aren't off the wall or new agey at all. You don't get more respected and mainstream than Nobel Prize winner Daniel Kahneman, and some of his research suggested that simply wanting can change your luck for getting. So, for example, in analyzing one study, he found that people who said when they were 18 years old that being very well off financially was important to them ended up wealthier 20 years later than others. Goals make a large difference, Kahneman asserted, noting that in the years after they stated their financial aspirations, many of the people who wanted a high income had achieved it. Kahneman reached his conclusion by looking at a study that followed 12,000 people over 20 years, beginning when they were just starting at elite universities. The initial questionnaire had students use a 4-point scale to rank how much they cared about money. On the follow-up, 20 years later, Kahneman looked at one group and discovered that for every extra point they had given on the money importance scale, they were making an additional $14,000 in income, the equivalent of more than $22,100 today. It's a pretty striking result. Announcing as a teenager that you're a 4 rather than a 3 on the want-to-be-rich scale results in a luck bonus that's enough to buy a new Honda every year. Most of us wouldn't mind that kind of lucky input to our own bank accounts. And we can all make that kind of luck. If you've told yourself at age 18 or any other age that having money is a top goal, you're going to set yourself on a course, consciously or unconsciously, to make that happen. You'll put in serious effort, get to know the right people, and land an entry-level job when you graduate that allows you to rent your own apartment. Your parents' friends, whose children are all back living at home, will wonder how you got so lucky. You can tell them that in order to find a pot of gold, you need to identify it. Only then can you follow the right rainbow. The study Kahneman analyzed didn't ask the 18-year-olds how important it was to them to become parents, work in the fashion world, star in a TV show, or volunteer in Ghana. But if it had, I'd be happy to bet that those who ranked any one of those options as a 4 out of 4 in desirability would be more likely to achieve it than those not as driven. Once you've acknowledged to yourself what you consider a lucky life, you start putting into place all the pieces to get there. Barnaby told me that he had recently met with Leonard Mlodinow, the Caltech physicist whom I admired, to talk about some mathematical theories. Barnaby wondered if I'd like to chat with him too. "Of course I would," I said. In addition to his academic work, Mlodinow has authored books with Stephen Hawking and written for popular sci-fi shows like Star Trek: The Next Generation. In his own books, he has pointed out that randomness plays a bigger role in some successes than we like to admit. A lot of things we find miraculous, I was walking down the street and ran into an old college friend, are examples of simple statistical chance. But I was interested in whether a guy who studied randomness thought we could affect our own luck. Yep, he did. When we gave him a call at his home in California one morning, he was charming and thoughtful, and he quickly agreed that random chance is only one element in the success equation. He thought that luck usually lands with certain personality types. "I just watched the old John Wayne movie True Grit," he said as we began our conversation. "Have you heard of it? It reminded me that successful people are usually the ones who don't give up. If you're thinking about luck as a rope with many strands, persistence is one of the big ones." As Mlodinow described it, talent and ability are important, but the willingness to forge ahead can balance them out. You have to keep trying and accepting failure, because the more at-bats you have, the more likely you are to get a hit, no matter what your skill, he said. He gave the example of two people of different abilities. One who succeeds 99% of the time, and one who succeeds only 1% of the time. Sometimes the less talented person can seem to be incredibly lucky at landing a great job or acting part or loving spouse. But there's a good chance that he's changed his odds by not giving up, and so having more at-bats. If you try 100 times, you might very well succeed, because then the statistics are on your side, Mlodinow said. It's how you turn a 1% person into a 99% person. In other words, the less obviously talented person who tries 100 times can have the same success as the superstar who tries only once. As the child of Holocaust survivors, Mlodinow understands at his core that we can't control everything and are sometimes caught in swirls of history much bigger than ourselves. He also recognizes the power of randomness in daily life and admits that he likes to trace back the instances that made a difference and how they occurred. We can all do that. If you left your office a moment earlier, you might have been hit by the drunk driver rather than watching the accident happen to the guy in front of you. Or if you hadn't sat a little longer to have an extra cup of coffee, you wouldn't have met the person who became your best friend. Physicists are very good at seeing life as Brownian motion writ large, humans being the equivalents of the little particles suspended in air, being tossed about randomly by the fast-moving atoms around us. Scientists have been fascinated by this kind of motion since the Roman poet and philosopher Lucretius wrote about it in 60 BCE. He described looking at the dust particles in a sunbeam streaking into a building and realizing that their dancing is an actual indication of underlying movements of matter that are hidden from our sight. Albert Einstein and others later brought some mathematical precision to the mystery, making the causes of the dancing less hidden. In real life, we may be tossed in Brownian motion, but that's not the end of the story. As Mlodinow put it, what really matters in your life is how you react to the opportunities and challenges that randomness brings your way. With all those random particles knocking into one another, the more times you head into the field, the more opportunities you'll find. One of the best ways to up your luck is to keep taking chances. And that's where Mlodinow's formulation that successful people are the ones who don't give up brings science and real life together. Once something has become hugely successful, it's hard to imagine how there could have been any other outcome. You look at what happened and take it as proof that it had to happen.